The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Last week, we started talking about execution in the marketplace, and we talked about e-business and how a major part of what we did in IBM to help formulate a strategy that we could execute was to leverage our base, which included the base of talent, the base of clients, existing products, with the new stuff. And that the way we framed it, and it was a very good framing, I think, well, it turned out to be pretty successful in the marketplace, is for IBM, the Internet World Wide Web, and e-business meant leverage the Internet to make what you have that much more valuable. And that's a framing. Other people would have framed it different, saying what you have goes away, get rid of it. That's a fine way to frame it. You have to convince your customers. And we talked about the some of the key aspects of organizing the strategy, the market strategy, which is balance between proprietary and open, in-house versus partnerships, what are going to be your key offerings, how are you going to measure your progress, and those are very key organizational things. But we also talked about a very important subject, that when you're talking about a disruptive technology like the Internet with a very big potential market, and remember, we talked about, you know, the goddamn Internet is just this incredible system. And as you know, if somebody said, well, where in this stack does the Internet play? You know, what makes it so disruptive is that it plays up and down. The more you go across, how do you focus your efforts? If you have something that complicated, if you just said, well, I want to go take on the world and I want to go and transform applications. No, no, take it easy. We may get there, but the first question is, what are you going to do first? Like, how do you get to first base, if you know what I'm talking about? Let's get there one step at a time. And we will talk today about customer-based experimentation. And first I'll talk about the work of Tomke, and then we'll talk about Eric von Hippel's work. And Eric was really nice in saying he'll join us at 2 o'clock, which is wonderful, because he will then join us in the discussions. I can't say enough about experimenting in the marketplace as a way to figure out what to do. If you're just doing pure technology invention, clearly you do that in the lab, and clearly you experiment in the lab. And if you're doing products, you would clearly prototype, build, etc. But innovation, especially now more and more, and what we're talking about in this class is, how do you take stuff from the lab or from somebody's lab? It doesn't have to be your lab. It could be MIT's lab, Stanford labs, anybody's labs. Take it into the marketplace. Now, the marketplace is a wonderful concept, but it's a cosmic concept. So you need to start narrowing down, what the hell do you mean by the marketplace? What, in other words, you have to tell me where is first base so that we know where you're heading. And a critical part of finding first base is marketplace experimentation, working very, very closely with clients. Now, in the past, marketplace experimentation was just too expensive. It was very difficult to do. First, it was very difficult to build anything in the lab, then to build a prototype. Remember, most of the channels to market, most of the dealings with clients, not most, all of them were people-oriented. There was no technology to help us do that. So it was just very expensive, so you had to be very careful. And often the market experimentation was another way of you announce your product and you hope and pray the marketplace likes it or your service. But this is changing. Companies now have an opportunity to innovate and experiment in a whole new way. What are some of the things companies can do to experiment? Well, you know, here is a long list. First, there is the internet itself, which, as you know, is the world's biggest platform for innovation, experimentation, and collaboration. Then is the fact that IT systems are so inexpensive. I don't know if you know, but the amount of money that, let's say, brand new ventures need to get going now is significantly less than during the dot-com days. And a big part of that is that during the dot-com days, they needed to get computers, they needed to buy all this stuff, and that stuff was much, much more expensive. Today, computers, much to the chagrin of companies like IBM, are dirt cheap, and especially to get going. And you can get software for practically nothing if you use Leap and LAMP and other open source stacks. So the cost of getting going is much less expensive. Even supercomputing, which before you had, you know, it was very expensive to access, you can do that much better, and on and on and on. So there is a whole set of new tools that very much enable you to experiment. And Thomke makes the point that companies need to take that into account, the opportunity for experimentation in their basic structure. That is, it's not like I go with the way I've been doing it for the last 50 years and I'll bolt experimentation at the end. That's not the right way to do that. He makes the point that you want from the beginning to organize your efforts in terms of extensive experimentation. What is an example? Well, if you have a huge team that needs to do something for production, which maybe is what you need, maybe you want to have a small black belt team that does a rapid prototype that you can even start making available as an alpha or a test bed to start testing out the ideas and then incrementally refine what you build so that you can start experimenting very quickly. I have to tell you, in the old days, people could bring, say at IBM and other companies, product plans that may have taken, I don't know, 3 to 5 years. Today, a plan that 3 to 5 years, it's not that it would be a joke. And if you're building a new semiconductor fab, that's a reasonable plan because you're building a semiconductor fab. But let me tell you, if you're building a software product or an application or a new service, three years, it's ridiculous. The market will have changed several times. So you have to think what you plan to do. I advise people, you know, tell me what you can get done in 6 months. Well, I need, no. I know you need more time, but what can you get done in 6 months? And then do that quickly, and then 6 months after that, and 6 months after that, you keep iterating. So it really changes the whole way you look at what you're building. It doesn't work in every case. I don't mean this is universal, but I'd be very worried if somebody says, Irving, it's 3 years or nothing. I'd be very, very worried. Please.
What you're just describing, it seems pretty obvious in IT and software industries. How universal is it?
Well, let me ask you who have experience in other industries, drug research in pharmaceutical, there's a lot of work about testing new pharmaceuticals much, much faster with all kinds of new technologies. Do you all want to talk about your experience in your industries?
In the drug industry, your plan skills are, to get out a drug, are very, the product plan would be something at least 10 years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But in the emphasis today is on failing really fast. And I don't know if this is this is connected with how fast we learn. But it seems like if you iterate and your iteration plan takes 3 years, you tend to forget as an organization what drove your iteration. Whereas if it's 6 months or 3 months, you tend to keep that in mind.
That's my feeling. And are pharmaceuticals making progress in doing that?
They're trying. However, the problem is every iteration costs a huge amount of money.
Yes.
So the question is between
I understand.
Balancing your money and your knowledge.
I understand. Yeah. How about other industries? I mean, in retailing, I heard this talk in June, the CEO of Metro, which is a big, big store, and we'll hear from Chris McCormick in a couple of weeks. We can ask him that 70% of new products on the shelf fail. By fail, I mean customers don't buy them. The products may be wonderful products. It's just if you define success as customers buy it as opposed to they are pretty and customers should buy it, then 70% fail. And this may get back to one of the questions that he mentions. If something is going to fail, if it's inevitably going to fail, the earlier you find out, the less. In fact, if something fails quickly, it's a learning experience. If something fails after you've invested tens of millions of dollars and years, it's a goddamn problem. So in some ways what we're talking about is there a way to do this so that whatever doesn't work, you find out quickly, because maybe what you're then doing is maybe weeding out a lot of the efforts, and you can concentrate on those parts that are most promising. Maybe that is what we're doing. But I know there are whole new drug sequencing technologies that even in wet labs allow testing of lots of stuff. Of course, genomics sequencing is coming way down. Simulations are enabling to view designs at a much faster way than ever before, supercomputing simulation and so on. But my feeling, and I really want to hear about your industries, is this may be one of the biggest innovation areas for every business. How do you reframe the way you do things to take this approach of start with something and then start refining and incrementing with the biggest opportunities? And it's not clear what to do, but do that. Now, this gets back to some of the things we talked about last week. Somebody said, oh, Irving, you don't know, I have to build this whole infrastructure. And say, well, what's wrong with the internet and open source? Well, I don't like Linus. Linus is a fine guy. So the more you leverage what exists, And open source has the nice characteristic, if you can use it as a platform, that you know, the price is right when you are starting out. It may not be great for scaling later. You may need to do things for scaling, but to get going, and if you use as much existing components as possible, obviously you don't want to steal anybody's IP, you just start way ahead of the game. You don't have to start from the bottom. You start from quite a bit. If you partner with others that have a base you can build on, a platform that you can leverage and then build on top of that, you can just go to market that much faster. But it's an interesting way of thinking. I know at IBM, you know, I think I have mentioned that I would say 10 years ago, people would think, well, you don't think I'm good enough to build the whole thing, that I have to go build it on Java, which comes from Sun, or I have to go acquire Lotus. Well, you're good, you're wonderful, but it will take you 3 goddamn years, maybe 5, and we have zero promise that after these 3 to 5 years, you'll be where they are today. Zero. So from a business point of view, that sounds dumb. So the more you'd say, okay, what's a base that lets me, it's a base that's not, that is an enabler for your innovation that lets you get going, the faster you find an existing base, the faster you can get going. And I think that attitude permeates VCs these days. That's why initial investments are so much lower than they used to be, because they expect everybody to use a base. Any comments on these points from all your experiences? Now, the third point that Sumkey makes is to, it's the same point essentially we just made before. By low fidelity, he means the early designs don't have to be the ultimate designs. They can be coarse designs that will show later, that you will keep incrementing later. So it's another way of saying pick approaches to design that enables you to incrementally improve them as you get information and feedback from the marketplace. That's what he's saying. And that's another way of saying that. And then finally, and again, we just discussed that, be very clear about what your unique innovation is. What is really new in what you're trying to do? That's where you should focus your energy. That's where you should take the risks. Now, you know, if probabilities of failures multiply, and you know, P1 times P2 times P3 quickly get very small. So part of combining new and traditional is if you build something new on top of existing components that are well understood, where the risk is minimal, you're just increasing your overall probability of success. And later on, once the whole thing is better, one of the first things you might do for release 2 is improve this component and get a better one. But now you have a stable product and you know where it fits. One way that I have thought about it often is that when you have a project, you know, think of a project and think of, I have this mental image, you know, lots of moving parts in the project. Well, if you have too many moving parts, the damn thing can never come together. And if the thing doesn't come together, unfortunately, it falls apart. So you want a kind of core around which the moving parts can settle down so that you are incrementally growing and then come back and start replacing the core. And that's a way of reducing risk. Please.
It seems like for, you know, you're anticipating exploit early information and fail early. And, you know, you're saying, you know, put the 80% solution out there and sort of, you know, you have to be careful with that, I think, because you know, you put out there in this 80% solution, but everybody doesn't know it's the 80% solution, or if it's really the 70% solution and everybody gets pissed off at you, and then even if you improve it, you have lost sort of the credit.
I agree totally. You have to be very careful.
There's a line there.
Totally.
Where that line is.
No, but remember, if we knew where the line is exactly, business wouldn't be business. No, because I think a lot of the innovation is picking the line. And I don't know, and I have a lot of emphasis on design in everything that I keep talking about and the marketplace. And a lot of the reason, and by the way, I mean design and the marketplace for the engineers, not for the MBAs that are doing whatever MBAs do. And MBAs we need to count money, we need to do a lot of stuff. But the kind of guidance about how to do a design that is suitable for the market you're after, where the 80% you do is correct, that has to be intertwined with your overall design. And if you are the design manager, chief architect, and if you have very good intuition about it, you can do a much better job than if you have to listen to what somebody else who's been out there tells you. But it's a huge part of the innovation, in my mind.
But also, failing does not mean having to put it out to the public. Like, when I develop a drug, I wouldn't test it on a human being.
Yeah, I understand.
Or a cat or something.
Yeah. Also, it may be simulation. Remember, in a lot of areas, the way you do early experimentation is massive simulation. But in cars, you might be able to do that. You might be able to design the car, start testing its aerodynamic qualities, its manufacture, you know, and the amount we can simulate keeps going out and out and out. So, out there is not necessarily customers in the usual sense, but we'll talk in the next section. Often it is, and of course there the key is select the right customers. Please.
But failure is, by nature it is defined by market, right? I mean, that's the way you've defined it. So how do you not go to the market and discover failure?
You to discover market failure, you have to go to the market. To discover that this car just has bad crash properties, that you can do quickly, or even, let's say, to show people, and that's why Detroit does concept cars, and actually not just Detroit, everybody does concept cars, right? And I think a lot of the reason for the concept cars is, you know, find out if people go bananas when they see the car, or if they say, this is the ugliest car I've ever seen, and they don't want anything to do with you. So, and again, my view is, through extensive use of simulations, modeling, you can probably get a concept car to a show much faster than in the old days where you had to rely on modelers. Isn't that correct? There's a tremendous amount more you can do today. So there's a whole set of techniques, but all of them are get it out there as quickly as possible.
But what kind of experiments can you do in the market to produce market things? That's really the frontier, essentially.
It is. And let me wait till the next section, because we'll talk about that very much in the whole next section. I agree totally that is the frontier, and we'll talk a lot about it. Yes, please.
I mean, in software, which is where I come from,
yes,
lots of sort of prototype mock-ups, you run it by lead users, and you just keep doing that very, very quickly, you can move through the process, and then you throw it out, right? And then you do it for real. And you have made all the mistakes very quickly up front, and sort of validated with at least some of the public, some of the consumer, that it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Then
right.
Even if that's a feasible model, just throw it out and do it right.
Well, that's why alphas and betas are so important. That's why, you know, as I think John Patrick mentioned, we developed this notion of alpha works because we had all these ideas in our research labs that had no channel to be experimented with in the market. So we said, well, screw it. Make it downloadable, and you know, the first time we told that to the lawyers, they had apoplexy, and we said, no, constructors and IP something, well, you sign here and say you will not use this for a commercial purpose, only for experimenting, and we did that. So that's a vehicle to get it out there. And software, there is a lot of experimentation of that sort. I mean, any of you that deal with Yahoo, Google, and so on, you keep getting gadget. Not, I mean, there are names for, what are the names? Gadgets and widgets and, am I correct?
Google Gadgets
and Yahoo has widgets, right? And I don't know what Microsoft calls whatever they have. Do we have an IBM widgets and gadgets? And, well, AlphaWorks. So there are... in software, there are... Now, somebody says, oh, can I run the Federal Reserve money transfer? We say, please don't. Or can I run a surgical operating room with that? No, we don't recommend that. So you have to be very careful about who you pick. Otherwise, your whole brand goes up in smoke if you pick the wrong sections. But if you pick the right sections, and in the next section we'll talk a lot about it, it's good.
It's interesting you brought up Google. They use beta. They put beta on everything.
Yes.
In fact, I think Google Maps is still beta.
Is it still beta?
Google Mail is still beta.
Yeah. And
everybody's using Gmail.
And
Gmail is beta?
Yeah. Everything's beta.
Yeah, they call it all beta. It's a marketing spiel. So if something goes wrong, like you don't get too angry, it's beta, right? So they get around all of that.
Now, but remember... let me ask you a question. How much do you pay for Gmail?
But advertisers are paying.
No, I know that.
Exactly.
I know that. No, but consumers...
But Yahoo has the same business model, yet when Yahoo Mail goes down, they get all kinds of irate users. I mean, it's a marketing change.
Yahoo Mail was beta for like 2 years before it became FCS now.
But Gmail has been around for like 4 years or so even more probably.
The key to Gmail is that their recovery process is, I mean, Google can, you know, they put code out every week, but if there's an issue, their rollback is within an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key to what they're, so they're able to kind of do production.
So that's equivalent of very quick failure and recovery because
right.
you are expecting that anything goes wrong, you'll immediately roll it out.
Or is that rapid experimentation?
It's both. I mean, again, remember, this gets back to why I think it's so critical that the engineers be very involved in marketing, because we're talking marketing. But this is the kind of marketing that can have a huge impact on your architecture. And if you don't have the right, you cannot do the rapid recovery. Somebody says, well, I know you built this architecture where everything is monolithic, there are no components. I want you to do rapid recovery. I don't think you can do that, right? It has to be built into the basic architecture, which is why these feedbacks are so important. You had a point?
Yeah, I just wanted to make, Tim O'Reilly calls it perpetual beta.
Yes.
So you never come out of
it. Yes.
You take it out to the marketplace, like just like what you said.
Yes.
And then figure out, for example, Gmail, they put out a new thing almost every day.
No, that's right.
And if they're okay with it.
Right, right. Remember, it depends on the product. I mean, it's very important to know that a hospital management system cannot be in perpetual beta. So you need to be careful about what products you need to use, let me call it more classic development cycles, and even the classics you can innovate, and what products are in the perpetual beta category. And in fact, I think that one of the critical innovations when doing any product is to look at the overall, and when I say product, I mean project, because it can be services, and almost analyze task by task and do a kind of triage. Is this part of the mission critical? Then it goes into this bucket. But if there are tasks that are not in that category, then you can, in your design, put them in a different portion and allow experimentation here and not in the ones that have to be mission critical. And that's a big change in design to do that kind of careful analysis of the tasks. Please.
One, Flickr was in Gamma,
Was in Gamma?
Gamma, yeah, that's Flickr Gamma. So, I was just out at Oracle, who does the same sort of thing as Google. They're offering SaaS type delivery now, and they're adopting the same Google model for mission critical apps.
Mm-hmm.
They're putting out incremental small patches every single day for the back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a sort of avoid criticism from
the customer by
putting it out
to data. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. So now let's switch over to democratizing innovation, which is available for nothing from Eric's website, which is a question you can ask him. How come everybody's selling their book? He has a hard copy of it, which I would encourage at least some of you to buy. It's a very nice book, but if you decide you don't believe in buying what you can get for nothing, you can download it off his site. And he makes a very big point about the changing nature of innovation and the distinction between manufacturing-based innovation or classic innovation that takes place by a manufacturer and user-centric innovation, which I think it's a little bit easier to talk about in the next slide. In manufacturing innovation, what happens is, if I'm the developer, you know, I get all the information, then I go on, develop the product by myself, build it, and so on, and then I push it into the marketplace. That's the classic approach to innovation. And that's been used more and, forever. In user-based innovation, the people using the product themselves are participating in the innovation, sometimes with the support of the manufacturer, sometimes without the support of the manufacturer, whether it's hacking or doing whatever they do. And what Eric has observed is the growth of user-based innovation, how important that has taken place. In the old days, you know, in this case, the users are passive. They buy whatever you produce. In this case, the users are very, very active. And where user-based innovation is most important is in the very early stages of a potential product, where, you know, you don't even know, so almost pre-alpha, you don't know what it is that you are going to be doing, and so you very much want leading-edge users that have the interest to work with you, to participate and help you. And, you know, once things become clearer and you are in the marketplace looking to scale up production, scale up support, and deal with users who don't care to innovate with you, then the more classic manufacturing principles take over. And this is extremely important, this user-based innovation, especially when you're dealing with projects of the kind of complexity that internet-based projects tend to have. Let me give you an example from my experience. You know, before I led IBM's internet project, I was very involved in supercomputing in IBM. And in particular, we started a whole line of parallel supercomputing in the early 90s. And at that point, that was happening at the same time as the massive bipolar to CMOS transition we've talked about. A similar transition was happening in supercomputing. And before that, Cray Research was the leader in supercomputing, and they had really exotic technologies, but their machines were incredibly expensive. And parallel architectures based on initially RISC technology started showing up and gave tremendous power at a fraction of the cost. We honestly didn't know what the hell we should be building. And what we did was pick a couple of key customers to be our launch customers and do something just for these two customers as quickly as possible. Now, the two customers we picked were the Argonne National Laboratory, which got DOE funding to participate here, and the Cornell Supercomputing Center, which is an NSF center. Well, you know, when you're dealing with universities and research labs, it's been my experience that they consider it an insult if you don't trust them enough to have them as lead users. In fact, before, you know, sort of the new IBM era, post near-death experience, IBM didn't know how to deal with them because products were products. And we say, no, here is the product. And they would say, well, but it's finished. Well, of course it's finished. We only do finished products. But we don't like finished products. We, you know, that only means you don't trust us. You don't think we should participate. And the answer was probably, yeah, we don't really trust you because you're a pain in the ass and you're so different from our classic commercial customers. So maybe we won't do business with you. And by the way, and pay the huge prices of being removed from tremendous innovation, which IBM did and others who do that. But not only the Argonne Lab and the Cornell Supercomputing Center were our clients, but in fact, the reason they got their funding from DOE and the NSF respectively is because they went to make the case that they would work with IBM to influence IBM's design. So that was even a feature of what they were doing, because that's what a national lab should do, have an impact on the private sector, and that's what an NSF supercomputing center would do. And the first machines shipped in April, and essentially, I mean, they were really not very good. But that, I mean, they were incomplete. And you had to do a lot of hand-holding. People from the lab had to go there. But, you know, you're dealing with national labs. Hey, these people, what's a little assembly language programming or you know, doing hand-coding parallel architecture? In fact, they almost became an integral part of our development process in doing this stuff. And the work with them allowed us to then release the first version of the product in a few months later. I think it was in October of 93. We shipped the first machines to them April 93. Then we shipped the first version of the machine in October. And at that point, we had a few more customers, including some commercial customers. But in supercomputing, commercial customers means petroleum companies and engineering companies. And then the following year in 94, we really announced the product. It became known as the SP2. And by the product, I mean any kind of classic cycle would say, you don't announce until you have this. But by the time we announced the SP2, we had been in the marketplace for a year. And it's almost like our people in the lab and even our people in the field had been in spring training in how do you work with... Remember, there's a whole process to how do you support customers, hold their hands, how many people you need. And, you know, if you start that, if you start practicing that once you ship the product, you're in deep trouble because the customers will want you to do it. But by picking the right leading-edge customers, all of a sudden, it just plays into your marketing. It just totally plays into your marketing. I've talked about an example for a new product and a new sort of pretty research-oriented product. Now, with commercial products, whether it's you know, mainframes or other things, the equivalent is to pick selected clients with whom you have a very, very close relationship. And that you typically pick five of them, would you say, or so, who become your early clients, who've been dying for the features that this release is taking to market, and with whom you have such a close relationship that even if they are really upset at you, they won't go by write blogs about it. But, you know, they may go back to the original release, but they would not embarrass you. And so you pick them very carefully, and you work very carefully with you. A big part of what you do here is you are supporting those early adopters directly from the lab. So, here you can do that. Here you need the whole field support mechanism and everybody else. But, in fact, I think what usually determines how many of these you can do is how many can you afford to support out of the lab and people flying in and people doing all kinds of things. And then you move in this area. Now, I would expect in the pharmaceutical companies, let's take somebody who's doing an experimental drug to cure a certain kind of leukemia, And there are patients that, they've tried everything else. And can you get permission to from the, not the FAA, the FDA to...
Well, I guess you have accelerated clinical trials. For
so you might be able to get special permission.
You still have to go through phase one, prove that it's safe. And you might be able to do that, you might be able to combine that phase one safety thing on these patients, with these patients, so that you have a faster time to market and faster time to improvement result. And that's what actually we ended up doing with a current drug, VX-950, clinical trials. We tested it on a bunch of patients who, for whom the traditional therapies did not work.
Yeah, so that's an example where these people are superb user, you know, leading edge users, and their care, the people who take care of them should be big innovators, right? I know people have said there's this famous hospital in Houston, the Anderson Hospital. I think it's the Anderson Hospital. They say, boy, when you if you go to Anderson, that's where they do the most advanced research, but it's not good to land in Anderson. Because, I mean, it's not a joke, but it means all the other things have not worked, so you are now landing. I mean, it's for what it does, it may be one of the world's. But the first heart transplant by DeBakey were done at Anderson in Houston. But you don't want to go there. You want to stay away from that. So this is a very interesting paradigm and approach. And by the way, as we are talking, keep assembling questions to discuss with Professor von Hippel when he gets here. Now, when IBM... in the 70s and 80s, decided for a variety of reasons to concentrate on just more pure commercial markets and commercial customers and avoid universities, avoid research labs because we didn't have those products. You could say, well, that was a segment you had. But we knew it even then, but in retrospect, it's clear what we were doing is cutting ourselves off totally from this incredible source of innovation. So it's well accepted that the supercomputing community is working on the kinds of products that a few years later will gravitate toward the general marketplace. And if anybody wants me to give you Exhibit A, how about the Internet and World Wide Web, which all came from the supercomputing community. They were the first users of both of them, let alone parallel architectures, you know, the browser, and on and on and on and on. So these lead users are incredibly important because no matter how good your labs are, your own labs are different than the users. They tend to be more developing technologies, developing products, and your people in the field are usually, one, not users, and two, they may not be as sharp as the users. They may be brilliantly sharp people, it's just that these people know their stuff so much better. So cutting yourself off from dealing with these users is a sin. I mean, it's not a sin. It's bad business practice because you're cutting yourself off from one of the biggest sources of marketplace. Let me give you another example, marketplace innovation. A few years ago, I had just become the chairman of IBM's Academy of Technology, and some people came to see me to give me the results of a major study that the Academy had conducted, and it was the impact of game players and related technologies, and they said IBM has to be involved in that. And I had no idea what they were talking about, but, you know, this is the Academy, so you listen. And essentially the point was that in the same way that supercomputing is foreshadowing where fields are going, a lot of what's going on in game players, a lot of what's going on in massively multiplayer online games, World of Warcraft, and then role-playing games like Second Life, are leading-edge indicators of where things are going to go. So I took that very, very seriously, and then we chartered a few additional studies, which eventually led to IBM becoming very active in virtual worlds and things like that. Another manifestation of this area is what you see happening, let's say, in social networks, where, you know, most of the time in social networks, MySpace and Facebook and so on, I think Microsoft is going to buy 5 or 10% of Facebook, $1.5 billion. But, you know, Facebook was done by a couple of kids from Harvard. I don't think it's clear which couple of kids. I think there are some lawsuits going on about that. And I don't know where MySpace came from, but, and Craigslist was done by, I forget his first name, Craig. Craig is his first name?
Newmar.
Yeah?
Craig Newmar.
And this is a very good example of user innovation, all these areas, that these people, whether it's Facebook in the Harvard example or the other ones, they were just done for themselves. And they started to do more and more and more, and then they found there was a market here, and eventually the commercial world discovered there was a market there. But what's very important here, you are a business and you're not watching what's going on in those people walls you. That's all I can say. I mean, something can happen and you'll be in deep trouble. Now, we've talked about a number of things here that lead users, by definition of lead users, are at the edge of this market. So, you know, in 92, 93, our lead users were the people most interested in parallel architectures. Our lead users now in supercomputing are interested in petaflop supercomputers, petaflops. You know, just enormous machines, and it's Los Alamos National Lab, University of Illinois, NSF Center, Argonne National Lab continues to be there. So these are the people that are just pushing the envelopes at every single level. They just want to keep the latest, and they will only partner with you and be your lead users, not your competitors, if you're willing to help build what they are looking for. So this is very, very important. By the way, you may decide you can't afford it. You may decide it's diverting your energy. So these are things you have to do very, very carefully. Another point that Eric makes in his book is the difference in knowledge that the more classic manufacturing people have versus the users. The users, by definition of users, are expert on their requirements. I mean, that shouldn't be a big thing, but if somebody came here and said, no, the experts on the user's requirement are market analysis people. So you hire your favorite market research company and they will tell you, no, those people, remember, market analysis by definition means you need information to analyze. When you are here in the marketplace, you have information. So that's when those companies can do their job. When you are here, there is no information. The information is in the head of these leading edge users, which is why if you try to apply the processes that work for more mature products where you get a lot of information and you do segmentation, you just totally miss these end users. So the users are the ones who have the information. Now, the manufacturers have a pretty good idea about what they can build. They don't know if anybody would buy it. They have a big space they could build. I mean, let's take an example, which again is at the leading edge of petaflop supercomputing. I mean, if somebody here says, I want a petaflop supercomputer for a certain amount of money, and the manufacturers have no idea how to do that, that's that, you know. You want it, but we don't know how to build it, so you have to wait. What happens is that eventually you have more and more information about what kinds of approaches you could take to a petaflop supercomputer, and there will be multiple approaches, and these people know the kinds of problems they want solved. And so now you start working with them to see, is what we can do something that can apply to your problems? And if you start getting a match, then all of a sudden you start making the connection between the manufacturer and the user. Yes?
In some of the examples that you've mentioned in the last few minutes, it seems like the manufacturer and the user, especially the lead users, are actually one and the same. So if you think about Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook or Craig in Craigslist, and even in the supercomputing example.
They were the face at the... No, it wasn't super... In the, let's say Facebook, they were the first at the beginning, but then weren't there other kids at Harvard using Facebook?
There definitely were, but the manufacturers were users themselves. So Mark Zuckerberg was a student who wanted to be able to interact, and Craig wanted to... In the supercomputing example, you didn't have that, but you ended up opening up the supercomputing, the source code and the infrastructure so that the users became
Managers
to some degree.
Exactly.
So in every example, it seems like instead of having a distinction...
No, exactly. In fact, that is the most critical distinction, that whereas traditional, you have a gap between the manufacturers and the users. In the world we're talking about, and we'll discuss how big is that world, those two are much closer together than ever. And that's your point, correct?
Can it happen in a case where the manufacturer isn't the user or the user isn't able to manufacture?
Well, it depends what you mean by manufacture. If we include software, then... And if you develop a layer of open source and you encourage your users to innovate in those layers, then your users are quote-unquote manufacturing. I mean, we can now argue, are they designing or manufacturing? But in the case of software, the difference is not very large. But, I think the users, by this definition, have to be actively involved in helping you design and build. And each case would be a little different, how active they would be. Yes, please.
So, come back to this point. I think in the case of software and, you know, the simple software, it's easy for the user to be the manufacturer. But in other cases, it may not. I might want a plane that is very fuel efficient, but I can't go and make.
No.
At least they can do the ask somebody to.
But even in Facebook, after a while, the lead users of Facebook could require the people who had Facebook, right? So after a while, there was more of a distinction between the manufacturer and the user. Or in the case of Google, there's a lot you can do, but there is the two are distinct. It's just that you're collaborating. Yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, FunHippo gives a lot of examples that are software-based, but he also gives the harder ones, like the surfer who modifies the board so that you strap his feet in. So
yes.
Actually, the manufacturer had nothing to do with that. It wasn't until later that they learned. And then the whole plant thing where he took the wires and,
yes,
you know, the user was a manufacturer, but he wasn't a manufacturer of that piece. But he
exactly.
figured out a better way to use it.
Exactly.
And I think that happens quite a bit, at least. Where I come from, we get something and say, you know what, it wasn't.
Remind me which industry.
Well, I'm in the Coast Guard, but we get something and we say, you know what, this is okay for this, but it's really good for this, and we'll use it for something totally different. And
do you give the feedback back to the manufacturer?
Sometimes. But
are they searching for the feedback from you?
Not really. You know, yeah. But sometimes if we need them to modify it on a global scale,
yeah,
we'll say, like at Cisco, we modified Cisco routers to do something through the RS-232 ports, and we asked them if they could do it. They said no, and we figured out how to do it. And then we went and told them, and now they sell it to be able to do that.
Did you give them the code?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we were like, hey, if you do this, we'll buy a whole bunch.
No, of course, and then you don't have to support it
exactly.
yourself.
Precisely. They modified it.
But that's a wonderful example of what we're talking about. Did you have Sung Yu? You had a point. Sung Yu is Eric's student, so he knows a lot about this area.
So I'm a little bit biased, as you might hear us, but I think the definition between the user innovation and manufacturing innovation. I have FunHippo's idea. I think it's based on how you benefit. So if you benefit from innovating just by solving the problems for yourself, then that's the user innovation. And if you benefit by selling the innovation that you did, then it's a manufacturing innovation. I think the point is a lot of users innovate because that benefits themselves, not by selling it. And these happen a lot in the marketplace. And because users have specific problem situation and they need to solve it, and no manufacturer is supporting that problem solving, so they have to do that for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this happen a lot, and you can see that in open source and the other
as
well.
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of key definition, and I think that affects a lot of conceptualization. Of
yeah. I think there's a lot more to talk about, but I want to make, there's a point that I think is very, very important. Why, I mean, we can ask ourselves, so why is this happening now? I mean, we can say, what's going on here? And I think it's a combination of factors. First of all, you know, in the quote-unquote industrial age, in the industrial economy, where it's primarily about physical things, you know, it's just harder for the users to be involved with physical things. They might harder. You know, you can hot rod cars. Hot rod cars are example. You take the car, you do different things. So it's not impossible. It's just much harder with physical things in an industrial economy. In a knowledge-based economy, where so much of the way you embody the function can be captured in software, which you would all agree is happening, and not just for classic software, but there's probably no discipline where that's not happening, the combination of it being software and then having the internet and collaborative technologies and the ability to distribute the software makes it so much easier to do this kind of distributed collaboration that would have been impossible before. Do you all agree that that's a huge change that is sort of industrial versus knowledge economy? And then even within, let me say, the IT industry, well, it's not just the IT industry, but in classic engineering, you tend to apply technology, you do automation with machines pretty much, or even on back office things. And you are working, here are the users, and you are changing things back here. Like if you're a bank, you're not going to have the users of the bank help you do the transaction processing system for the bank. That would be really bizarre. So the transaction processing system is a very good example of a back office system that supports the operations of the bank, and obviously that's where a lot of the initial innovations happen in IT. Or, you know, medical record management. You know, you're not going to have your users work on the security of medical record systems. That's not what you would do. But as we talked before, we are increasingly innovating up the stack. We are getting to the layers of problems that are services, that are not industrial, but are services in nature. Services, by definition, means a person is doing something for another person. I mean, that's what a service is. And those may be employees helping each other, it may be a doctor treating a patient, it may be somebody selling something to somebody else or giving them information. So the services portion of the economy involves people dealing with each other. It's a part one hasn't focused much in engineering because we haven't had any goddamn tools to do anything with. Say, well, we'll automate this service. Well, I don't want you to automate this service. If I'm the patient, I don't want to interact with an AI doctor. I want a doctor. So we say, well, then screw you. Well, then I'll go away. But because of the new technologies we have now, internet information analysis, supercomputing, we can start bringing a whole plethora of new tools to enable the people performing the service and the people receiving the service to better work with each other. You're not automating the doctor, you're providing tools for the doctor to better serve the patient, like maybe tools that let them know the genomics makeup of the patient so you can do prescriptions much better. Or maybe also information about what treatments have worked for a community of patients. And maybe in that case, the innovation may happen between the doctor and a community of patients that had the disease and were treated, who are providing information, how well they felt, how well they didn't feel, so you get this user innovation. So everything that Eric is talking about, the reason it is so profound is because I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg. That is, I don't know if because of tools like this and techniques like this, that's what's pushing us into the knowledge economy and allows us to bring technology and engineering to services, or because we're in a knowledge economy and in services, we can do stuff like that. But there's something that feels very different from classic uses of technology and engineering. Do you all agree with that observation? Please.
Well, one thing is user innovation may not always be what the manufacturer wants, right? Because it has, for example, if you take the example of Apple iPhone, unlocking the iPhone might be a user innovation, but the manufacturer won't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's user innovation is a good thing, but it might actually violate the...
No, I understand. I agree totally. And we don't know yet whether unlocking the phone is good for Apple or not, because you need a little time to know whether Apple refusing you came just in time. We'll ask Professor von Hippel this very good question you brought up. Let me first introduce you to Eric von Hippel, who wrote the book Democratizing Innovation. And Eric, before you got here, I had made a comment that a critical part that why user innovation is so important now is, in my opinion, two critical things are changing. One is we're moving, please, from an industrial economy to a more knowledge-based economy. And in a knowledge-based economy, a lot of the innovation is being captured in software, which makes it easier to do this innovation as opposed to physical things. It's harder, not impossible, but harder. And the second one is that in the past, we didn't have the technologies, the tools to innovate at the services layers of businesses and economies. And by definition, services involve people doing things for each other. We were innovating in the more back office part. You can see why. I mean, John is so good. Of course, he was out there. And we had VP of marketing, and he was out there. Also, it depends on the thing we are most careful with is financial analysts. That, because if you say the wrong thing to financial analysts, there are even legal implications too. So you have to be careful. IT analysts and press, the reason you have to be careful is because if you are not savvy about how your words could get interpreted, you may find reading something and Sadwick said, I never said that. Well, but Sadwick, maybe you said something that could have been interpreted as you said that. Also, once you do this, you become good at reading what the reporter is trying to take you to. And if you think they're trying to take you along a certain path, you start taking them along. You know, you need experience. And I believe that experience is very, very important. I think in the first lecture we had in class, I think one of you asked me, well, isn't that the job of marketing people to communicate that? Remember, we're talking about disruptive innovations, complex technology, complex systems. The people that are often the best with press and analysts are the technical people who have a really good in-depth understanding and who can best represent that. That is, yes, you have these messages, but the really good technical people know where these messages came from, what's behind them, and they will be very, very good at reacting. And if you don't have that, you are just you come across a little more shallow. Now, I don't mean you're shallow, you just don't have the depth. And analysts and press, they can smell that. They can smell that, oh, so this is where I have to go. Whereas, you know, they know that no matter where they want to go, boy, this person is really well prepared, and this person is also market savvy and articulate because he or she has thought about it. It will just be easier. So it's a very big part of the job. And the alternative is that you do wonderful work and then you read in the paper that your competitor is getting all the glory and you'll say, I've been out-marketed. And that is humiliating. If somebody's going to out-market you, let them have a better product. But there's nothing worse than you have a superb technology, a superb product, you didn't pay attention to these scenes, and your competitor walked away with all the glory, and you have a better technology and product, and you can write a book whining about it. But I cannot tell you, the marketplace could care less about you.